Well, Frederick Douglass was born 200 years ago, and today Valentine's Day is the day that he chose for his birthday. He was born in Maryland in 1818, the son of an enslaved woman and a white father. He survived extreme brutality at the hands of a sadistic slave owner before escaping to the North and eventually freedom. He became a famed orator and writer, an ardent abolitionist who advised presidents. We asked David Blight to tell us about the life and legacy of Frederick Douglass. He's one of the country's leading historians of the American Civil War, an authority on Frederick Douglass, a professor of American history at Yale University. His books have received many prestigious awards, and for our purposes, there are two about Frederick Douglass, Frederick Douglass's Civil War, and Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. And David Blight joining us from the studios of Yale University. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning to you as well. I know for a while you taught high school for 7 years, and we were just talking about this study from the Southern Poverty Law Center about how slavery is not taught in many high schools in this country. Anything you want to say in response to that?
Oh, sure. In fact, I read that report, and I actually wrote the introduction for it.
Yes, you did.
It's a tremendous report. It does what many studies of education have done. It did a lot of good surveys. There's a lot of great survey data in there. Of course, the results are, as usual, fairly depressing about what students know and don't know, and even what teachers know and don't know. But what it points toward are methods or ways of trying to teach about a problem like slavery, 250 years of it in North America, and yet still fit it into broader narratives of American history and the broader expectations of American history that most people grow up with. The problem with teaching slavery, and it's always been this way, is that most Americans still, by whatever means they come by this, still want to believe that their history, our history, is a history of progress, is a history of a people getting better, a people solving great dilemmas, a kind of chosen nation. These are deep, deep values, some would say mythologies, that have driven American history. But you can fit slavery into that because slavery was there at the founding. Slavery was part of the making of the United States. Slavery was at the core of the American economy for the 80-some years of the Republic before the Civil War. Slavery is right at the heart of the destruction of that Republic and its remaking in the Civil War. You really cannot understand the country's history without understanding slavery. But then the other dilemma comes from the fact that slavery is a brutal, terrible, inhumane institution. And sometimes people just don't like to hear about it. But history's full of things we don't like to hear about. And the purpose of historians, the purpose of teaching good history, is to make people face the past, whatever the truth is.
Well, Frederick Douglass can teach us a lot, and that's one of the reasons that we wanted to have you join us on Radio Times. And as I said in my introduction, he chose this day for his birthday, so he was born 200 years ago today, according to Frederick Douglass. He was just a little bit of, I guess, biographical material. His mother was an enslaved woman. His father was white. Do we know who his father was?
No. He didn't know for sure, and we still don't know. There are two primary candidates, both who were his owners, Aaron Anthony and Thomas Auld. Aaron Anthony was the owner of Douglass's mother, Harriet Bailey. There's lots of circumstantial evidence that his father may indeed have been Aaron Anthony. But there was some circumstantial evidence that it might have been Thomas Auld. These were his two principal owners. And he spent a great deal of energy in his life, throughout his life, trying to figure out his paternity, even trying to figure out his birthday. But he never fully did.
Well, and it was Mrs. Auld who taught him, I guess, the rudiments of reading, or certainly taught him the alphabet. Do we know why she did that?
Well, it's interesting. Her name was Sophia Auld. She was the wife of Hugh Auld, who was the brother of his owner at that point, Thomas Auld. It's when Douglass was sent as a boy to Baltimore, one of the lucky breaks of his life, being in an urban setting in a city. And Sophia all took him in as almost like a son. He was there to be supposedly the playmate to her own white son. And at first, she was Douglas called her an angelic figure. She was a mother figure. He was only 7, 8, 9 years old, for that matter. But she did. She taught him his alphabet, his ABCs. She read to him out loud for most of a year. And she had him reading with her, particularly reading the Bible, believe it or not, at that age. And then, as he tells us famously in the autobiographies, her husband, Hugh, one day came in and said, no.
And that was the end.
It was the end of her teaching him, but she had given him the magic. She had given him the weapon that would make his life, remake his life. And for the rest of that young man's life, for a lot of reasons, words became his power. Words became his weapon.
Well, I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Clearly, they became his weapon as an orator, as a writer. He wrote three memoirs or biographies. But let me ask you about what he describes as a turning point in his life. He was, I guess, sent to this guy named Edward Corey.
Covey.
Excuse me. Can't even
That's
read
right.
my own handwriting
That's
here. Covey,
okay.
who was known as a slave breaker. And it seemed that this was just a horrifying life for Frederick Douglass.
It was for a while. He's about 16 years old. He had been sent from Baltimore back to the Eastern Shore, back to be, in effect, a field hand. Mm-hmm. After he'd experienced the city, after he'd been a dock worker in Baltimore, after he'd been going to churches in Baltimore and free black community gatherings, he's sent back, and he's living with his owner, Thomas Auld, and having a miserable, terrible time of it, and Auld couldn't handle him. He was a rebellious 16-year-old teenager, and Auld hired him out. This is what were done sometimes with slaves. They were, in effect, rented. He was rented out for a year just up the road, essentially 4 or 5 miles from where Auld lived in St. Michael's, Maryland. And for most of that year, he was under the brutality of Edward Covey, who was known to be a man who could handle rebellious slaves. Mm-hmm. Well, Covey did beat him mercilessly, according to Douglass's accounts, but at one point, Douglass stood his ground and claims he had a 2-hour rumble fight with Covey. Now, who knows if that lasted truly 2 hours. What it becomes, though, is the great pivot in his narrative, in his first two autobiographies, where he says, I have shown you how a man was made a slave. Now I will show you how a slave becomes a man. Mm. Now, that's a very male-driven narrative. And there's a lot of gender in that. But it became a crucial turning point for him, at least in his memory, because by standing up and fighting Covey, Douglass says Covey never laid another hand on him the last few months he was there, but he went through a great deal of brutality, beatings, and humiliation, emotional humiliation under Covey. Covey broke him for a while. He really broke his spirit, but Douglass survived that year barely.
Well, let me quote something. You referenced this, and this is where Frederick Douglass talks about this turning point in his life. He says, it rekindled the few expiring embers of freedom and revived within me my own sense of manhood. It recalled the departed self-confidence and inspired me again with a determination to be free. Sorry, I have a little froggy voice there. I'm not crying,
okay.
Although those are really very inspiring and powerful.
There are parts of Douglass's narrative that can make you cry.
Absolutely. But this determination to be free and to take on, especially a man with a kind of sadistic a track record of Edward Covey, to take him on and essentially, at least from Douglass's point of view, to win that battle.
Yeah, well, we don't know exactly what happened, but a Covey without his whip in his hand was probably a bit of a coward.
Hmm.
And that 16, almost 17-year-old young slave, was a strong, strapping young man. But he knew that the consequences of standing up to a slave owner in a fight could be death, I mean, at least.
Sure.
But remarkably, if this all happened the way Douglas gives it to us in his account, Covey was so embarrassed that Douglas had beaten the stew out of him that he didn't want people in the neighborhood to know. So he basically let Douglas go. And in the following year, when Douglas was 17 going on 18, he was hired out again to another slaveholder in the area, but a very different kind of one, a man named William Freeland. Not making up the names now, that was his name. And that particular slave owner treated Douglas without any brutality at all. And it was on Freeland's farm where Douglas began to teach. He would go out in the woods with his friends. He called them his band of brothers. And he would teach them how to read. He would preach to them. He would read from the Bible with them. It's the first time Douglas kind of stood on his feet and became a preacher.
Well, David Blight, we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about the life and legacy of Frederick Douglass. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoing, talking with David Blight. He's one of the country's leading historians of the American Civil War. He's also an authority on Frederick Douglass. And Frederick Douglass was born in 1818, 200 years ago. And he said today, Valentine's Day is his birthday. So we are marking that birthday with a discussion about the life and legacy of Frederick Douglass. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We were talking a bit about this Frederick Douglass essentially standing up to this slave owner, Edward Covey. And then a couple of years later, he organizes an escape. It is unsuccessful. Yeah. And then a few years after that, he manages to escape and make his way to the North. How was he able to do that?
Well, that first plot you mentioned was on this Freeland farm. I mentioned this other owner he was rented out to. It was with a group of fellow young male slaves, but it was betrayed by one of them. They were caught, and they were actually dragged in chains for 10 miles or so into Easton, Maryland, and put in. Douglas was jailed for 2 weeks after that plot was discovered. And by all accounts and by all odds, his owner could have and perhaps should have sold him south by the way slavery worked, but he didn't. And Thomas Auld sent him back to Baltimore. Douglas says that Auld promised him that if he would be in good behavior till age 21, he would free him. And in effect, Auld said to him, you know, you're not a very good slave. You're incredibly intelligent. He goes back to Baltimore when he's 18 years old, and for the next 2 years he lived in Baltimore, which had more free blacks than it did enslaved blacks. It's then that he met the woman who would become his wife, Anna Murray. He got involved in two or three different churches, white churches and black churches. He was involved in a debating society.
As a slave.
And he worked on the docks, and his owner, Hugh Auld, now, would allow him to keep small portions of the money. Small, very small portions. Almost all of the money he would make had to go to his owner, which only increased Douglas's resentments. And his plot to escape was essentially this. And Anna Murray, his fiancée, in effect, helped him plot this. So did a few other people in Baltimore. Hmm. He dressed himself as a sailor with a big wide-brimmed cap and a big sash on it. He borrowed a sailor's maritime papers. It's like an ID form that sailors had of a retired black sailor. It even had a picture on it. And the scheme was that Douglas would jump on a train at a key moment, you know, on a morning train out of Baltimore, dressed as this sailor. And he did just that. It was a drayman, you know, like a cart driver, who drove him to the train just as it arrived. He jumped on. And by three trains and three ferry boats across rivers, including the Susquehanna and the Delaware, in about 36 to 38 hours, he made it to New York City.
There's another quote from Frederick Douglass. I'm not sure at what point he says this once he makes it to the North and senses that moment of what it is to be free. He says, "What a moment this was for me. A whole year was pressed into a single day. A new world burst upon my agitated vision. I felt as one escaping from a den of hungry lions."
He had an amazing ability to probe his memory like this. Well, he's writing that about 7 years after he escaped. But he had an amazing ability to probe his memory and then retell these stories. And almost always he captures you as a reader through a metaphor, the hungry lions.
Yeah, I mean, he's a fantastic and compelling writer for sure.
It is amazing what a writer he was so early in his life. It truly is.
You have called Frederick Douglass a radical, honest patriot, but clearly he struggled with our history, certainly with slavery, with, I guess, the words of the Declaration and the Constitution, the Bill of Rights.
Right.
So his love, for the United States, would that be fair?
Yes, it was both. It depends on when you look. It's all a matter of time and place. Douglass delivered in the pre-Civil War decades. I mean, he becomes a public orator as of 1841, but from 1841 to the Civil War, 20 years, he became one of the most famous orators in the United States and probably the most famous itinerant abolitionist speaker. He delivered some of the most ferocious critiques of American hypocrisy over race and slavery, of American racism, of the meaning of slavery. Anyone ever delivered. In fact, his greatest speech, his rhetorical masterpiece, is the 1852 Fourth of July speech. And I call him a radical patriot because his patriotism is born out of his radicalism. It is in the wake of emancipation and the remaking of the United States Constitution after the Civil War on the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that Douglass does become an American patriot, because it's the America that was refounded, remade in the Civil War era, in all of that bloodshed, that really was the nation Douglass was embracing. But long before that, he had been chastising his country over and over again to live up to its creeds. He loved the Declaration of Independence, the four first principles. He just said the country should abide by them. He loved the natural rights tradition. He said it belongs to everybody. It doesn't belong to just white people. He loved the idea of human rights. And, you know, he was both the ferocious, embittered critic and ultimately an American patriot. In fact, when he came back from England in 1847, his first trip to England, he was an incredibly angry young man at the age of about 29, going on 30. And he had just been 18 months in England, where he was treated so openly and so well as a basic human being, which he had not really been treated as in the United States. And he came back so embittered, and he would make these speeches in which he would say, "I have no country.
Yeah,
I have no, I cannot live here as a citizen. I have no country. I have no country." And even some of his radical colleagues, like Wendell Phillips and others, took him aside and said, "Frederick, tone it down." But he didn't tone it down. It took him a long time to embrace the country that was his.
Well, David Blight, we have a selection or a section from the famous speech that you mentioned. This was delivered on July 5th, 1852. What to the slave is the 4th of July? We asked WHYY engineer Al Banks to read an excerpt of this speech. Let's give it a listen.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your national greatness, swelling vanity, your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mock. your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. Would you have me argue that man is entitled to liberty, that he is the rightful owner of his own body? There is not a man beneath the canopy of heaven who does not know that slavery is wrong for him. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument is needed. Oh, had I the ability and I could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and its crimes against God and man must be denounced.
And again, that's WHYY engineer Al Banks reading an excerpt of Frederick Douglass's 1852 speech, What to the Slave is the 4th of July. David Blight, I have chills listening to that.
I do every time I hear it, too, especially with that voice. Wow.
Yeah, he's
I mean,
good.
If you what people need to do is both read that speech and hear it, and listen both for the substance and the style. This is a rhetorical masterpiece of a speech. Note his use of repetition. Note his use of opposites. Note his use of a cadence. And that cadence is actually a King James cadence. He learned his language from the Bible. But in that speech, you get it so direct. Hollow mock, bombast, scorching irony, biting ridicule. He is just chastising his nation and calling them to the altar, calling them to their creeds, telling them, in effect, if you don't change your ways, you are being destroyed by this system of slavery. What that speech is one of the greatest Jeremiads of the 19th century. Douglass took his sense of history, his use of language, largely from the Old Testament Hebrew prophets. That's where he learned language, reading Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Amos. And if you read that speech juxtaposing it with some of the old Hebrew prophets, you'll begin to see where he gets that language. But the ultimate purpose of that speech is to tell America, if they don't change their ways very soon, they are destroying themselves with this system of slavery. And he was right about that.
Well, it's interesting. He said, oh, had I the ability and could I reach the nation's ear? I mean, he was one of the most eloquent speakers, orators, abolitionists of his day. He obviously was and influenced or certainly had conversations with President Lincoln, for instance.
Eventually.
Right.
When the war comes.
Not in 1850.
But you need to remember that at that point, 1852, abolitionists were always outsiders. Now, he had an audience that day of about 500 people in Corinthian Hall in Rochester, and mostly a very sympathetic audience. But he was a very clever, radical entrepreneur as well. He had printed copies, pamphlet copies of that speech ready after he delivered it. It was a formally written speech, and he immediately went on the road to take this out on the trail, and he sold copies, you know, for 50 cents of that speech. It was fairly widely read, but people need to remember that abolitionists were considered dangerous, radicals, outsiders, and always people who were somehow threatening the social order, and that was exactly the point of that speech, to threaten the social order and to threaten American sense of history. Take us back now quickly to that tolerance report.
Yes.
Out of the Southern Poverty Law Center. If someone's teaching about slavery, start with this speech. It's 20 pages long. You can use excerpts or the whole thing. Start with this speech. Where is America at in the early 1850s? It's in a horrible crisis over whether its future is going to be slave labor or free labor. And here is Douglass standing up on the, well, on the day after the 4th of July, and telling the country its fate. Now, that language, that story, would draw students in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then you can take them. You can take them into the political crisis over slavery, and you can take them into the nature of slavery for the people enslaved. Because ultimately, that's who Douglass is trying to speak for. You know, your 4th of July, it's yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. But that I pronoun is speaking for 3.5 million slaves. It's not just about himself.
I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. David Blight, let me ask you about a piece you had in the New York Times yesterday, how the right co-ops Frederick Douglass. What does the right see in Frederick Douglass that means something to them?
Well, they've been doing this for years now. And by the right, I mean the libertarian right and also the formal Republican Party. They've adopted Douglass because, well, Douglass was a Republican. He becomes a Republican with the Civil War years, and he was a loyal Republican the rest of his life for 30 years, from President Lincoln and then President Grant all the way on to the 1890s. There was no other political party for black people to adhere to. But that was a very different Republican Party, at least in the war years and the early Reconstruction years. But the one thing that conservatives, and especially the libertarian wing of conservatives, link onto is Douglass's belief and his frequent speaking about black self-reliance. Wow. He was not alone in doing that. Most black leaders preached a kind of self-reliance to their people when they were free, and also after the war when they were freed slaves, you know, to help themselves, to build their own communities, to create their own agriculture and so forth. And Douglass at one point, he began early after the war, he would say, blacks must work for themselves, and he would say what the country should do is free them, help them get land, protect them from terror and violence, and then, quote, let them alone. Hmm. Now, by letting them alone, he didn't mean abandon them, but the right has seized on that language, and they have therefore said, which this new book from the Cato Institute does, that Douglass was a great proponent of rugged individualism. That's just one small element of Douglass's thought and Douglass's political action throughout his life. If you only seize on that one element of Douglass in his lifetime, you've missed most of what he was ultimately about. Douglass cared deeply about human rights, about the collective use of human rights, not just about an individual's rugged attempts to lift himself up.
Well, David Blight, I'm sorry to say we have to leave it there. I know there's much more to talk about.
Sure.
Thank you for joining us today in Radio Times to talk about the life, the legacy of Frederick Douglass.
You're welcome. Thanks.
You're welcome. And David Blight, a professor of American history at Yale University. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.